rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want. We want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huck will return in 2 weeks. Today's show, we interview Andy Merrifield from Sonoma State University and Nick Bam from California State University East Bay, who are representatives from the California Faculty Association Union. They've been planning, along with 26,000 other faculty, a statewide strike that would have closed 23 California State Universities April 13th and affected 450,000 students. Last-minute concessions from the CSU administrators have postponed the strike until faculty can vote on a new offer. We will speak briefly with Jennifer Egan, president of the California Faculty Association, for an update. We'll also talk to college professor Nolan Higdon, who teaches part-time in four colleges. He's part of an increasing segment of college instructors working without permanency across the country as higher education systems are cut back on hiring tenured faculty. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. We've been faced April 13th with a strike at 23 campuses across California that would have affected 450,000 students. Our two guests today in studio are Andy Merrifield, who's from Sonoma State University, and Nick Bam from California State University East Bay. Joining us online for an update on the strike and the concessions that have happened from the CSU administrators is Jennifer Egan. She is the president of the CFA statewide, joins us from Sacramento. She's a professor of philosophy and public affairs and administration and has done research in critical theory, feminism, and governance. Jen, thank you.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you. And Andy Merrifield is here with me, and Nick Bam are with me, both with different campuses. We have good news to report. This is April 8th, Friday, and we're very happy to hear that we're not going to go on strike. Tell us what the concessions are.
We reached a tentative agreement with the CSU. They did provide us with a 5% salary increase, which was our number during the campaign called the Fight for Five. That 5% salary increase will be effective June 30th of 2016. There is a 2% salary increase that we will get the very next day as part of the subsequent year of the contract, and a 3.5% general salary increase for academic year 17-18, and a step increase for eligible faculty in 2017.
Well, this is certainly increases that have been long needed and long expected. What concessions did the faculty have to make? There's no retroactive pay, correct?
There is no retroactive pay of the 5%. But I think it's important to note that the retroactive pay for 1 year is a small amount. That 5% plus the additional raises onto a base salary is exactly what we've been saying the faculty need. We need regular and steady salary increases to be able to dig out of the hole that has been dug for us during the recession and our flat and stagnant salaries during that time. So this is a great step forward for the faculty. We're moving from austerity to looking forward to much more regular raises that are going to give financial stability to a lot of faculty members.
Well, certainly it's been a long time coming. Contracts over the past 10 years have not kept up with inflation and been extremely difficult for many faculty members across the state. Are there contingencies, though, if the state, as it did in 2008, and the taxes aren't coming in, what happens with our contract agreement?
We have Article 41 of our contract basically echoes HERA, the Higher Education Employees Relations Act. If the state budget completely fell apart, if there were a financial apocalypse, the CSU would have to renegotiate the contract with the faculty, and we'd be obligated to come back to the table. That would be the case as a matter of law, regardless of what's in our contract. But there are no contingencies beyond that in the new agreement.
So what's next? Faculty will vote. Trustees have to approve this. What are the steps we have to go through?
The TFA Board of Directors voted to put this agreement forward to the membership for a ratification vote. That vote will take place online between Friday, April 22nd and Friday, April 29th. So by the end of the month, that vote will be completed. We will plan to announce the results of that vote on Tuesday, May 3rd. And then that would complete the ratification process for the faculty, and the CSU Board of Trustees would vote to ratify the agreement at their May meeting, which I believe is May 24th and 25th.
You're president of the California Faculty Association, statewide union of 26,000 members. This would have been one of the largest university strikes in history. Is that correct?
It might be one of the largest strikes that didn't actually happen.
So we're certainly glad of that. But it was a long time in preparation. I mean, this has been months and months of negotiation. Andy Merrifield will speak to that, I'm sure. But it kind of went to the brink. And we were staring at walking off on April 13th, the entire system. So what's your perspective? Was that strike? Is that what turned the table?
I think a lot of factors came into play. I would certainly attribute the activism from faculty on the campuses as being absolutely key. You know, we had the Fact Finders report, which found in our favor at the end of the statutory bargaining process. That certainly exerted a lot of pressure on the CSU to settle the contract. And it also fueled a lot of our political allies behind us. When an independent, neutral fact finder makes that kind of decision, it really does force the hand of management to settle. It showed that our interpretation of the data had been accurate all along, and that our faculty really were in need, and that the CSU could afford the raises.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. It's certainly a pleasure to hear from you. You take the time out to speak to us from Sacramento on this busy day, and we certainly appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to talk to Andy Merrifield, who's a professor of political science at Sonoma State University. His areas of interest are complex organizations and public budgeting. He's also a member of the California faculty bargaining team for the last 12 years, four of which he was chair and up till last fall. So he served four terms as associate vice president for Northern California for the California Faculty Association, CFA. Also joining us is Nick Bam. He's a professor of ethnic studies and the California Faculty Association chapter president at CSU East Bay. His research involves African-American spirituality, sexuality, jazz, cultural studies, James Baldwin Scholarship, an author of numerous books and a blog writer. He's a native of San Francisco. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Andy, let's start with you. 12 years on a negotiating team. Talk about the process that happens when unions are negotiating at this scale with management at a system like California State University, which is one of the largest university systems in the country.
The first thing to take into consideration, as Jen Egan just said, a lot of things had to come together to bring this in at the last moment, and it has always been that way. Part of the problem is that it's multi-layered. From the national level all the way on down, the defunding of public higher education, the attempts to deprofessionalize the profession by hiring part-time temporary people and trying to lowball them in prices has always been part of the problem. In the state of California, neither the legislature nor the governor has put the kind of priority on the California State University, which is the largest comprehensive public university system in the United States, that it deserves. Also, when the legislature does give money to the CSU, the California State University has a tremendous amount of discretion on how they want to pay it. And because of the things I just mentioned, the discretionary is in the payment of the faculty, etc. So you put all of that together and you start off with a certain level of mistreatment or benign neglect at the very best. Added to that is, for years and years, the trustees saw us as sort of an enemy rather than a cooperative model. So every year we have had to start all over to try and justify that what we were trying to do. And one of the things about bargaining, for people who know anything about it, is it's not a rational process. What you do is you go in with the best arguments, and we always have good arguments, which is why, by the way, this is the fourth fact-finding that we have won against management in the last 10 years. But nonetheless, you not only have to have that, you then have to push and you have to press. And quite frankly, there are times when it seems as if the university wants to wait things out. This, I think, is regrettably why it took 12 months on something that could have been settled a very, very long time ago. So what happened this time is not unusual. In 2007, the last time we got a really good contract that unfortunately got aborted as a result of the collapse of much of the international economy due to the profit-taking, etc., that happened in the banks, etc., we also got right up against it before they moved. So what we do at the table is critically important for laying out the arguments for the fact finder, for laying out the arguments for the public, for laying out the arguments for the legislature, for laying out the arguments for the governor. But all the other things have to be a part of that, too. It's a sort of octopus of communication, outreach, factual data, etc. And unfortunately, we work with, at times, a system that seems to be interested only in can you force us to do something? And that's the irrationality of the process. And quite frankly, it's maybe a little more difficult sometimes for people in higher education because we're trained to look at evidence and things of that nature.
Nick Bam, you're president of the California Faculty Association on your campus at CSU East Bay. What was your chapter doing to prepare for this strike that ultimately now we're not going to see? But what were they doing, and what's the situation on campus for faculty members, both full and lecturers, in terms of just surviving? It's an expensive area. What are we looking forward to here?
Well, let me just answer the last part of the question first. On our campus, as on the other campuses in the 23-campus system, there are profound systemic inequities. So we are dealing with highly paid top-level management, and we are dealing with a bulk of lecturers, up to 50-60% on most of our campuses. Of our courses are taught by lecturers, many of whom are paid at rates, at wages that are at the poverty line. So, you know, I work in a department with people who are earning $28,000 a year to do what they do. They're providing valuable services for our students. They're providing courses that count for graduation, right? But there are profound inequities in the system as they look at managers who are paid high six-figure salaries, et cetera, and they wonder why they're not being compensated for the work that they do and for the training that they have.
And these are people with PhDs.
These are people with PhDs, yes.
Exactly.
That's correct. And they're terribly angry. We have an experience, a very unique experience at East Bay. We only share this experience with Dominguez Hills. We went on strike in 2011. We were a campus that had it. My campus was ready to do this. We know what the process is. Organizing was easy. The mood on the campus was that people were, frankly, fed up. They know that the CSU has the money to compensate us. They are aware of the systemic inequalities on the campus. They see it every day. They were ready to go. So we had, frankly, quite an event, a series of events planned for the strike week. And I would have estimated, even with just our campus alone, that we would have had hundreds of our faculty on the line. In fact, our response rate was incredibly high. Our vote for the strike system-wide was about 95%.
92%, yes,
yeah.
And a huge, huge turnout of our members, in excess of 80%, voted with the 92%.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're looking at a state system-wide faculty over half making less than $50,000.
That's correct.
And in most areas, that simply is not going to get you into a home, barely rent an apartment, maybe. Hopefully you've got a partner that works as well. Mm-hmm. It makes it really difficult. Versus now there's, you know, tenured track faculty, once they're in, spend 6 years getting permanency, which is what it takes, then they can perhaps get by, but that's become more difficult as well.
That's correct.
What's happened over the last 10 years, either one of you, what's happened in the last 10 years in terms of increases for us all?
This goes back to what I mentioned earlier about deprofessionalization. We aren't replacing our tenure track. A faculty member is being replaced by multiple numbers of lecturers who don't get as high a pay scale, etc. So the number of tenure tracks is disappearing, which means that the profession is suffering as a result. So that's one thing.
I would just say that, you know, we need to remember that the CSU is the people's university. So if our administration is not investing in tenure track hiring, if our administration is insisting on hiring as many part-time contingent faculty as possible, you are essentially communicating to the people and the children of the people of California that their education is not valuable enough to make a substantial investment in it. I don't think that's something that the people of California, frankly, believe or would tolerate. And I think it's incumbent upon us, and I think we were doing this as we were organizing for the strike and feeling that wave of support that we're getting in the state. We have been educating people in California on what the system is like and what their children are actually getting when they show up, and they're paying these now much higher fees than anybody's ever paid before for this education. We're the people's university. We've got to bring the right product to the people so that, you know, the students in California, the children in California, can move up into the middle class and beyond.
That's the voice of Nick Bam. He's a professor of ethnic studies and California Faculty Association chair at CSU East Bay. Also in studio with me today is Annie Merrifield, professor of political science, emeritus at Sonoma State University, and a longtime organizer with CFA and on the negotiating team. So both of you, in the past decade, there was a good contract 10 years ago. It didn't materialize because of the economic depression. And there have been some slight increases. It was an $80 across-the-board increase a couple of years ago. But that left us way behind. How does CSU stand in comparison to other faculties around the country today? Andy?
Well, if you adjust for the high cost of living in the state of California, we're behind and we're getting farther behind. And the problem is a national problem. The California State University isn't the only one that is suffering, but we are getting farther and farther behind. And this goes back again to a kind of deprofessionalization. The university was trying to compare us to parts of the country that just don't make any sense, to compare San Francisco, where as recently as 10 years ago, it took about 10 or 12 years of your gross salary to buy a median-sized house in the county in which you live, compared to places like, one example, Wayne State in Detroit, where it took a year and a half. So this was kind of sleight of hand. This is the regrettable part of dealing with them, because as Nick just said, the people of California don't want this. If one good thing that came out of this mess over the last 10 years is that during the struggle, they tried to demonize the faculty as somehow greedy, but when parents heard what was going on and students heard what was going on, I feel very confident in saying they understood we weren't the villain. It was the legislature, the campuses, etc. But we have gotten farther and farther behind to the point where it's sometimes difficult to recommend to people, get your PhD. As we all know sitting at this table, this is a great profession that does a great deal of good, but it's also the way we try and feed our families.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. After that, we'll come back. We'll talk more about how the CSU is the people's university and the impact on students. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. In studio with me is Andy Merrifield, professor of political science at Sonoma State University and a member of the California Faculty Association negotiating team, and Nick Bam, who's professor of ethnic studies at CSU East Bay and president of the CFA chapter there. We've been talking about how the strike that was pending for April 13th has now been adverted, that there's an offer on the table with concessions from the CSU administration. And we were going to start talking about student support for the strike and the impacts that the CSU has on students today. Nick, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, students get it. I mean, they understand that their learning conditions are tied, in effect, to our conditions, our labor conditions. You know, I want to speak again to this issue of the CSU as the people's university. Most of my students are working two jobs, if not more, in order to pay for these recent fee increases. They want to see increased quality, right? They want to see well-paid faculty who are able to dedicate all of their time to working for them. It's very difficult for them to stomach paying the kinds of fees that they're paying and having faculty who are teaching here and then have to get in their car and drive a distance down the state to go teach another class and don't have time to invest in the grading of their papers and being online for them to respond to their questions via email or to provide the office hours that they need. It's that kind of engagement between faculty and students that actually makes education happen. Right? So this thing that Andy's been talking about the deprofessionalization of what we do, and in fact, the kind of neoliberal agenda that has taken money away from instruction, this is incredibly damaging to our students. They're not getting this quality time. They're getting, in effect, what amounts to a kind of a McDonald's of higher education, right? And as we all know, you can't get full off of McDonald's, right? How can we get our students full education-wise, right, so that they can move to master's programs or other professional programs and earn a decent living themselves? They get it. So to answer your question in short, the student support, especially on my campus, has been tremendous. I've got students who are sending me emails and stopping by my office and asking me about the strike and pushing us forward.
I think students have been very supportive. Other labor unions have come forward in support. That's probably all a factor in terms of getting concessions from the highest levels in the state, the trustees, to agree that we needed to move forward on this. But Andy Merrifield, let's talk a little bit about, certainly when I was at a CSU back in the early 70s, there was no tuition. I mean, it was $50 a semester. So what happened? What do we mean by a neoliberal agenda?
The thing is that the defunding of the university didn't start with the recent spate of globalization. That was sort of a steroidal push forward. A long time ago, we dedicated ourselves to creating a public university system to create a middle class, but that middle class was really thought of as mostly white male veterans. And over the course of the first 15 years after World War II, there was some money poured in. But then the neoliberal agenda said this is too expensive. Plus, if you get an education, you have an aspiration to go into the middle class. And there weren't going to be middle class jobs. Plus, of course, the push for full civil rights for women and people of color, etc. And so there's been a gradual deprofessionalization. I mean, if we can't keep the students out, if we have to accept them, we can defund them. So it isn't a conspiracy, it's a common purpose. And the common purpose is, it's not that they're unwilling to open to some people, but they want to have a gatekeeper. And the university isn't a gatekeeper. The university opens up a floodgates. And so what you do is you defund. You have made higher education into a private good when, in fact, it is a public good. Even our previous chancellor, who we had problems with forever, admitted, for every dollar we invest, we get $5 back. But to others, they say, well, they ought to pay the full freight. So it's been this, and it's partially, don't create aspirations in an educated group of people and then say, by the way, there's nothing for you, because those people will be angry, and they'll also be competent in dealing with that anger. And so that's part of what it was. Again, I'm not suggesting conspiracy, just a sort of common view of how America ought to be.
Nick, what do students pay when they come to, they're a freshman today coming to California State University, East Bay. What's the tuition, and what do they end up, if they don't have rich parents, what happens?
On most of our campuses, our tuition is around, say, $6,800 annual tuition. But it doesn't stop there, because you've got to pay for a living, right? So your housing can more than double that up. It's possible that a student walks away at the end of a given year having put in about $13,000 to be there for a year. What I'm seeing is students who have $30,000 in debt, $40,000 in debt, $50,000 in debt, etc., by the time they leave, right? And the question is that, for a minute, without critiquing the debt issue, which is a whole other game, right, that is related to what Andy's been talking about, if you're going to accrue $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt, do you get a degree of value that you can take anywhere in the world to get you where you want to get so you can pay off that debt? Right? That's the issue. Are we providing that level of quality? Is it worth it? And our students are not stupid. At some point in time, they're going to start evaluating. Is it worth it for me to get $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt? Am I getting something that's worth that?
Exactly. And that debt is not forgivable. They couldn't file bankruptcy to get rid of it. Theoretically, you could go your whole life owing that. And when you get Social Security, they'll take it out of your Social Security check.
That's right.
I mean, it's kind of a long-term debt slave this sort of process. And I use that word quite seriously.
Right. It's like buying a house without having a house, right?
Exactly, right.
Who would do that?
And, of course, and the transformation in terms of the economy and the jobs, they're simply not available. Right. I mean, you end up with people with BA degrees that are fighting over barista's jobs.
That's right.
In the coffee shop. That's an incredibly difficult thing.
That's right.
Where do we go from here? I mean, we've got a contract. an agreement, if the faculty accept it, that helps improve things. What else is on the agenda for us, Andy?
The next step is that, yes, we will be members of the bargaining team, the officers, the leadership, like Nick and myself, will be going out, talking to our members, explaining the contract, seeking ratification, seeking a yes vote. But this doesn't fix everything. In fact, we still have problems of inversion. Inversion means faculty hired at the bottom of the trough are actually making less than people that have been hired lately. We clearly do not resent the people being hired lately getting more money because they're still underpaid, but it does create an inversion problem. We have to deal with that. We have compression problems created because we went so many years without raises that the difference between mid-level and lower-level faculty is getting too close. All of those things will lead to continuing problems. The talk about using lecturers means that the service to the university is being done by fewer and fewer people. The diversity of the university means that we now have faculty who have to deal with first-generation students, some from backgrounds that have not had any family. All of these things have to be faced. This contract gets us some money now. It helps people stabilize their lives. The contract, by being extended, helps a little bit on these things, but none of these things are going to go away, and they're all critically important to keeping the university doing what Nick said. We want a high-quality degree for our students, and we want a middle-class existence for our faculty, and the things I've just mentioned, inversion, compression, etc., are still part of the conversation, and getting this is a small step in the right direction, and we recognize that, but the rest of it's going to continue.
Up next, we're going to be talking with a part-time college instructor who teaches part-time, and I say that sort of euphemistically, in four campuses spread across the North Bay. He's Nolan Higdon. He's a Project Censored affiliate professor and teaches in a number of places. Nolan, are you with us?
Yeah, happy to be back.
You're joining Andy Merrifield from Sonoma State University, CFA negotiator, and Nick Bam, who's a chapter president at CSU East Bay. And we're, of course, covering the breakthrough that has happened statewide, that the CSU administration has offered some concessions and that we're not planning to go to strike on April 13th. Tell us about your journeys on a weekly basis. Where do you teach and how many classes?
First, I want to say the CFA did an amazing job, did some great work, and it's a really, really nice step forward. So I'm happy to see what's been done so far. Typically, in any term, you know, I could teach anywhere from sometimes it could be as low as 4 to 6 classes. Sometimes it could be as many as 8 to 10 classes. It depends what a part-timer is offered. You guys were just talking about a moment ago, part-timers tend to make less. So to get something equivalent to full-time pay, they need to work more than a full-time load. And that means driving around a lot of campuses. Most of my day is spent in the car and checking emails. That takes up much of my day going from campus to campus, and there's many sort of problems with it. But one is, from first the instructor point of view, you're always looking over your shoulder, because even if the campus loves you and you do a great job and the faculty love you, you know, if they hire another full-timer who takes out a full-time teaching load, that means they no longer have classes to offer you. So that means you need to go to apply to another campus. So one way you can protect yourself is working at multiple campuses, but even then, you're eating up more of your time for less pay. From the student perspective, part-timers, when you're coming in to give one lecture and then one office hour and you have to go off to your next gig, you lose out on knowing a lot about what's going on at the campus, and that makes you less helpful in some cases for being able to help students. And so the typical experience was to sort of go around from campus to campus and kind of filling in the gaps where you can.
Nolan, you live in Davis, and you're commuting to what campuses?
I think the train down from Davis, CSU Maritime, East Bay, and then a couple of community colleges throughout the Bay as well.
So that means, how many miles a week are you driving? That's why they call you a freeway flyer, is that correct?
Right. So I call myself a road scholar. Somewhere probably around like the 500 miles roughly a week.
That's quite amazing. And so this is how the university systems have evolved. Literally half the classes in the CSU are taught by lecturers like yourself, and they may often be bouncing around from other campuses or trying to pick up a class at the JC as well. A number of people, including myself, did that for 20 years before I got hired at Sonoma State. I taught at Sacramento City College part-time and a number of others. And it's not an easy thing because you're vulnerable and the pay is much lower and you're expected to do a good job. with students, but it's really hard.
Having this massive amount of part-timers is not really good for the universities, for students, or for the state of California. And so while we're talking about these budgetary issues, you know, I really encourage my colleagues and anyone else to really think about also discussing students and tuition, reducing this cost. And we need to provide public education. Otherwise, you know, we could put a Robert Barron's name on the top of the school and start charging any exorbitant amount. But I think that that's something that we need to get into the discussion as well.
Nolan Higdon, thank you very much for joining us on the air today. We think this is a reoccurring difficulty in universities all across the country. And we appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Andy, let's turn to you now. Does this contract offer better support to contingent faculty, the part-time people?
Yes, it does in a couple of ways. Obviously, it increases their general salary along with the permanent faculty, which is beneficial. But it also has a part in it that will explicitly change the way long-time contingent faculty, many of them who are full-time, go up the steps. If you are a tenure-track professor, you get a promotion to associate, then you get a promotion to full. If you are a lecturer, there's a very complex formula that basically works against them forever. In this new contract, there will be a negotiation between management and the California Faculty Association to establish different guidelines that will make it easier and more predictable for lecturers to move up, and it will be based on a binding arbitration. If the two sides cannot reach an agreement of how to bring this together, an arbitrator will come in and establish a way forward for them. The very fact that we are talking about it and is binding means that even though we don't know exactly what it's going to look like, it will be a real improvement. Plus, the step increase based on service that will go into effect on your anniversary date in 2017, a huge proportion of lecturers will be eligible for that, which will add, instead of a 10.8% increase, we'll get them closer to 14%. So there's a number of things in there. And if I could just comment briefly on the previous speaker's concern about tuition. The California Faculty Association is proud of the fact that we have always advocated that there should be no student fees. This is a public good and should be publicly financed. So many unions, for very good reason, say for us to get ahead, the customer, the client, will have to pay more. The California Faculty Association has always sided with the students to keep fees as low as possible, and we would advocate not to freeze tuition. We would advocate to roll it back because the students shouldn't be abused. As Nick and Peter, you have both said, this is the people's university.
We're going to take a short break here. We've been hearing from Andy Merrifield and Nick Bam, college professors and members of the California Faculty Association, on the date that we look like we're not going to go to strike, April 13th, and that's really good news. So let's take a short musical break. The Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will be joining us again in 2 weeks. Andy Merrifield is in the studio with us, political science professor at Sonoma State University and a member of the California Faculty Association bargaining team for the last 12 years. And we're just announcing that on April 8th, there was an agreement reached between the CSU administration and the faculty. And also joining us is Nick Bam. He's professor of ethnic studies and CFA chapter president at CSU East Bay. So we've experienced a kind of a joyful breakthrough, and it looks like there will be a contract in some respects passed by the faculty, or we're going to look at it, and there's certainly some concerns, but overall it met the wage expectations that I think we wanted to see. So I want to talk a little bit about tenure, because I think that's really important for people to understand. It's sort of like a lot of times people think, well, if you got tenure, then they can't fire him, or they could be a bad professor and that kind of stuff. But tenure takes 6 years at least, plus you've got to go and get a PhD, which can take several years in addition. So you've already put in a decade or two decades preparing to become a tenured professor, certainly demonstrating your capabilities. Nick, why is tenure important in a university system?
Tenure is important in a university system in order to protect free speech, especially for somebody like me. I teach African American studies. There's a lot of stuff that I have to talk about in front of my class in terms of contemporary and historical issues that may be controversial. In fact, a part of my mode of teaching involves engagement, discussion, and we don't have to agree, right? I don't force anybody to agree with me, but we have to raise relevant topics. I would say, too, the tenure is also important for me to be able to do what I'm doing now. I can't really freely be an activist on the campus, saying the things that I say, advocating for faculty, if I'm constantly looking over my shoulder for the possibility of getting fired should I say something that administration would disagree with. So, you know, in essence, it's about protecting freedom of speech. If you're going to promote free thought in your community, you have to protect people who are bringing that free thought, right? There has to be free thought within the university, period. That's really what tenure is about. Tenure is not about protecting bad teachers. It's also not about not getting fired. I can still get fired, right? If there's something that I do that's totally out of line or frankly illegal, I'm out. I don't have a job for life, but my freedom of speech is protected.
So you can address, you know, controversial topics.
That's correct.
Be politically active.
That's correct.
On campus, you can speak out against the administration open way and feel relatively safe.
That's correct.
From being fired.
That's correct, because part of my job requirement is also to engage the community. It's to do precisely what we're doing right now, right? This is something that if I was in the tenure process, I would take a photo of you and put this in my tenure portfolio as part of my community engagement, right? But I have to be free to be able to say what I need to say to you and to respond to your questions truthfully and honestly and to address the people of California in the same way.
So why has tenure been coming under attack from neoliberal perspectives, I guess, around the country, certainly neoconservative perspectives? We're seeing a diminishing of tenure in Florida. Certainly an attack in Wisconsin. What's going on here? What is the agenda that you see it playing out?
Well, for me, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I think I agree with some of the things that Andy has said about common cause. I think that that's a better way of phrasing it than conspiracy. But for me, I see it as an attack on free speech. You don't get a neo-fascist agenda from a right-wing Republican candidate without the precursor of diminishing education, right? You know, the stuff that's coming out of his mouth only makes sense to people who are uneducated, right? Or who are looking the other way in some way or the other, right? You only get that if you can attack free speech in the country.
I think there's certainly elites in the country.
That's correct.
Very conservative elites who, with piles of money, sit in rooms and talk about liberal college professors with tenure that are speaking out too much and they'd like to get rid of them.
That's right.
I would call that a conspiracy. And we think that that's certainly happening and is happening in some states as we speak, and certainly a concern that gets brought up politically across the country. And you're explaining that tenure is about free speech. So
absolutely. That's the root of it.
And it keeps the university. Andy, you were going to say something there.
Yeah, I was going to say, everything Nick has said is absolutely correct. And, you know, this demonization of the faculty goes back forever. There's also a little bit of don't look at the man behind the curtain kind of thing, the Wizard of Oz kind of thing. If we can get people fighting over tenure and trying to crush discussion, then they won't be looking at the bigger picture. But I also wanted to say that one of the things the California Faculty Association does is we try and provide the same level of academic freedom and free speech for those who don't have tenure. We can't do it as easily, but the California Faculty Association believes every faculty member must have absolute academic freedom to explore what was being done. Tenure does preserve that, and I'm not disagreeing at all, but I want to make it clear, we as a union think that is critically important for everybody, but the reality Peter, if you've been a lecturer, and I know I was a lecturer, you're always a little bit intimidated.
You're always a little careful. Even if you've been hired tenure track, but you're not yet tenured, you're a little intimidated by to speak out against the president or on controversial issues until you have that safety.
You don't really feel safe until you're a full professor, because if you're not a full professor, they can try and deny you a promotion. And all of these things come into play. And I absolutely agree, whether we call it common purpose or whether we call it conspiracy, there are people that are attacking the university. And I'd like to say, gee, and this is something new. Tragically, it's been going on forever. It's just speeding up and getting worse.
If it's possible for me to add, too, I know that conservatives believe that what we're doing on our campuses is we're turning everyone into liberals. That's false. I teach conservatives. They remain conservatives after they leave my classroom. My job is
to teach
them. Better educated conservatives. It's to teach them critical thinking skills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that seems to happen based on research is we don't move people from being right wing to left wing, but the very fact that they're at the university, and it's not because of the faculty, it's because they're at the university, we might raise their level of tolerance, and that's a good thing, regardless. And the other thing is, as faculty members, regardless of our own political ideology, we also engage our students, and sometimes we learn from them, too. And it's a humanizing, working with people whose politics are very different than your own. If you learn a little bit about them, it's not only beneficial to your other students in the classroom, it's beneficial to you as faculty, too. And so academic freedom does mean freedom for everybody, including the students. And you can't do that in a place, as Nick pointed out, you've got political candidates. One of the failed presidential candidates, Marco Rubio, said, we don't need philosophers.
That's right.
What we need is welders. There's more money in welding. The first thing is, there's more money in philosophy than welding, and I am not putting down welding. It's a perfectly wonderful thing we need to do, but they even lie about that. So we have to be careful.
We're talking with Nick Bam. He's a professor of ethnic studies, a California Faculty Association chapter president at the CSU East Bay. And Andy Merrifield is professor of political science at Sonoma State University, longtime member of CFA, chair of our local chapter, but also is on the bargaining team for the past 12 years with the CSU. We're here announcing, and certainly updating everyone, and that is of April 8th. The CFA Board of Directors had reached an accommodation, a concession, certainly from the CSU administration, that gives the faculty a 5% raise quickly, and that had been what the faculty was asking for. What else does this agreement give? Give us an update on that, Andy.
Well, in addition to the 5%, and then followed by the 2%, followed by the 3.5% and a step increase, it also raises the minimum progression or the minimum amount of money you get at the time of moving up from an assistant to an associate or an associate to a full, meaning tenure tracked and tenured, from 7.5% to 9%. This means that those people that have been here a long time and faced the compression, their salary is getting too close to the people who are much more junior or inversion making less. It will be an opportunity to put a little bit more money in their pocket and move things forward. That is a benefit. One other thing is we are changing the calendar of negotiating. This may sound like inside stuff, but it's not. Now, the CSU and the California Faculty Association will negotiate a contract in advance of making a budget proposal to the governor and the legislature, so that it won't be that the CSU says, this is all the money we got, this is what you got to bargain for, too. We will bargain what you need, and we will go together to the legislature, and that will help us. And both of those are huge, though they may not seem so apparent to people who are not fully aware of the complexity.
And this is certainly good news, but it's not the solution to what's concerning university at this level. I mean, certainly they're not saying they're going to hire more tenure-track people. If anything, we're breaking even. And certainly at Sonoma State, there's fewer tenure-track people and tenured people than there were 10 years ago, with 50% more students. So it's a laying on, you know, class sizes instead of 25 are now 40, 45, and even larger. Is that happening at East Bay as well?
Absolutely. It's absolutely happening at East Bay. It's discouraging, I think, for people that we teach who we would like to see in our profession. So, you know, a classical example of this is at the end of my evening yesterday, I teach a 4 to 7:30 class. One of my former students, who's now a PhD student at UC Berkeley in environmental sciences, she's doing quite well. But she started out with us at East Bay tending bar in order to make her way through it. Actually took her a little bit longer to get through the program. Some of her work is on Gullah communities in South Carolina, Georgia, Seacoast area. She's been following this very carefully. She wants to come back to the CSU and teach and provide her services. You think about how valuable that person is. Someone who had to shoulder that high tuition. Someone who was up, you know, 2-3 in the morning, tending bar, and then waking up to go to 9-10 a.m. classes, right? Who would totally understand the struggle of all of our students. And yet, you know, she's following our struggle. Is it worth it for her as a kitchen table issue to teach in the CSU? If there are attacks on tenure, is it worth it for her to teach in the CSU? Or do we lose an incredible California talent like this to another state? I think that's the last thing we in California want, because we've always considered ourselves leaders in this country. And I think that is our proper role, right? Do we lose talent like this going forward because of some of the issues with tenure and pay?
Well, we had actually, in 1954, set up the plan for the state of California, the CSUs and the UC, and free college education for those qualified. We're way away from that completely. Mm-hmm. So now students are faced, even at the CSU, which is a relatively good deal compared to the rest of the country, is still several thousand dollars a year, plus living expenses. So people can be vastly in debt if going through a 4 or 5 year college program to get a BA degree with no good job guarantees coming out of that. This is Peter Phillips with the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We've been talking with professors from the California Faculty Association and the avoidance of a strike April 13th, and we're very pleased about that. We'll return after this brief musical break. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. In studio with me today are two college professors, Andy Merrifield, a professor of political science at Sonoma State University and one of the mediators and negotiators for the California Faculty Association, and Nick Bam, is a professor of ethnic studies at the CSU East Bay and a chapter president for the California Faculty Association. We've been talking about unions, and the CFA union, national union, is now statewide has not going to go on strike April 13th, and we are back to voting to accept a contract that actually looks fairly decent, so we're pretty pleased about that. I want to ask both of you, what are the implications for this settlement for unions at other college campuses around the country? Nick, can you speak to that?
I think that we've pushed back a little bit. I'm not going to claim that we have made a significant dent in the systemic inequalities that are in our system, but we've pushed back for the professionalism of what we do. This is really about fighting to recover that. And what I'm hoping is that we've created much more than a spark here, okay? That there's a real flame and we've started something burning and we can start to roll back the tide. It is very much my intention as an activist at Cal State East Bay to push back for the People's University. So in addition to fighting for fair wages for faculty and providing quality for students, we are also undoubtedly going to be undertaking a fight to roll back fees for students. We're going to be on the line for students, too. That is a fundamental part of the fight.
Andy?
I would say one thing about the success of this. The California Faculty Association is the largest faculty union for comprehensive university. There are big unions in New York, but they're wall-to-wall, meaning staff, etc. And we have become really important. Had we lost this battle, it probably would have harmed similar battles in places like back east, etc., where these kinds of movement. So what this does is we help support them as they have helped support us. So I think in that case, we have always been perceived as very, very important, especially with lectures, etc. So this is good for the union movement in public higher education. And a defeat would have been very, very bad because other states have the same problems we've been talking about earlier about the demonization of public higher education. So this is a win that's going to go national.
I mean, you use the word defeat, but what we're really talking about here, there was going to be a strike April 13th. It was going to be 5 days. And that would have closed every CSU campus in the entire state. However, we were going to reopen, and students would have still graduated. If the administration hadn't come forward, where did we stand? Would we have not opened the classes, the universities in the fall, and really gone on strike?
That was a possibility. When I was talking about a defeat, I wasn't talking about the strike being a defeat.
Right.
Had we ended up with the 2%, the inadequate amount that they were willing to offer, that would have been a defeat. Had we struck and they not moved, we would have escalated, and the escalation would have been reasonable and proximate to what they were doing, and there was a very strong possibility there wouldn't have been a fall term if the CSU had not moved. And we believe, based on all the other things we did, that that also was something they had to be thinking about.
Well, I think 26,000 faculty standing together, full-time, tenured, non-tenured lecturers, is a very powerful statement to the powers that be nationally, and a message across the world, literally, that faculty can stand up and make very important statements. I want to talk a little bit briefly about, too, is the nature of tenure. People, you know, we talked about this briefly, but what is the process for a college professor? What did that person go through to get to the point of being a tenured full professor? Nick, can you speak to that?
Yeah, it's an incredibly rigorous process, although I think it's relatively transparent for us in the CSU. A number of campuses, you simply are waiting for 6 years, and then there's one final determination, and you've got it. For us, there's an evaluation process every single year. So potentially, if you don't meet up to standard within that 6-year period, you could be relieved of your duties. In fact, it has happened. So we're evaluated in terms of our scholarly production. That is, you know, are we publishing? Are we publishing books? Are we publishing journals? Are we publishing journals? Are we publishing in the right journals, right, that are germane to our fields? We're also evaluated in terms of our teaching. Our course syllabi are evaluated, all of them. Our course evaluations, what students have to say about us, are evaluated. Our community outreach and community participation is also evaluated, as well as what we do on committees in service to the university. So in those four areas. And it's not one committee. So you will have a committee that's essentially sort of more of a department committee. It will then move on. Your dean will evaluate you. Your college will evaluate you. There's a university committee that evaluates you. And ultimately, the president has the final say-so in whether you're going to receive tenure. But again, for us, it's not just about that end point in 6 years. You're evaluated every single year. There's always stuff put in your working personnel action file about what you're doing. So it's an incredibly rigorous process.
And that's after you've been hired somewhere. So
that's
Andy,
correct.
Speak to, say, a young person graduating in political science, and they want to go on to be a college professor. What do they have to go through to even get to the point of being able to apply?
Well, at this point, you know, a bachelor's degree is only the first stepping stone. Then you have to get an advanced degree, a master's, and certainly in a field like political science, a PhD, a terminal degree in your field. Which
and that
in
can
itself,
take how long?
Realistically, these days, to go from a bachelor's degree to a PhD at a Research One university is about 6 to 7 years on average, even though they say you could do it in 4. But that's light speed. And during that time, you have to try and get opportunities to be a teaching assistant to get your feet wet in the classroom. Frequently, you become the lecturer at the community colleges or even at the CSU. And then when you're all done, you have to publish your dissertation. You have to have feelers out at dozens and dozens of universities. You're competing with people that might have been lecturers for 10 or 12 years. And because that's what you're facing, no matter how good you are, because there is such a dearth of tenure track positions. So it's a terribly rigorous thing while you are accumulating debt to get through graduate school, and then you're living kind of hand to mouth with these incredible long days like our colleague was talking about as a freeway flyer. And then at the end of the time, the jobs disappear. As you pointed out, we actually, CFA fought and got the legislature to put up $11 million additional dollars for more tenure track positions this year. And it ends up that we got a few more. There was actually a net increase, but we've lost thousands. So that's the world that you're looking at. And the reality is most people become political science professors, or they become professors in ethnic studies or sociology because of the love of the field. With the amount of time, money, and effort we put in, sometimes it feels like, shouldn't we at least be able to make a living? So we're doing this because we really are passionate about working with students and moving ahead.
And it's bleak. And university systems need this. I mean, a university is a place where all disciplines are present or should be present. It's a diversity of ideas and information. It's a place where students can come and learn and develop themselves. And as faculty become their mentors in a variety of ways. So you don't need, 100 students. 25 would be good that you can work with and get to know and be engaged in. And so we see these increasing class sizes and the numbers of students we're supposed to be advising as growing rapidly across the state. And these are things, I think, that are issues we'll need to be addressing in the future to come. So the faculty have now stood up to the CSU. We had collectively agreed that we were going to go on strike April 13th. They blinked. And we have some concessions. What kind of labor support did we have across the country, Andy? Can you speak to that?
As Jen Egan said at the press conference, the Surface Employees International Union of California was supportive. The California Teachers Association was supportive. And then she read a list of all the other unions, non-governmental organizations, social welfare, social justice organizations that played a tremendous role. We expected on the picket lines from April 13th through April 19th, members of other unions. We expected on the picket lines members of the California State Legislature.
Students.
Thousands of students, but beyond just our own campus, because everybody knows this is where the aspirations of the American people or the people of California is in educating their children. This is really the central place. And union families, I've had the good fortune to work with the Postal Service Union in providing, looking at scholarship applications for those students. This is one of the great dreams. And they know that our fight and their fight is the same. And they were stepping up for us. We were doing outreach to them, and this wouldn't have been a few disgruntled faculty members and a couple of students looking for fun. This would have been thousands of faculty, thousands of students, and thousands of people from the community and the labor movement all working together for the benefit of California.
Would have been worldwide news, and it should be worldwide news in the fact that concessions were made. And the trustees, of course, are appointed mostly by the governor, so that's a very political situation that's ongoing. We've just got a couple minutes left, Nick. Would you like to add into this conversation here wrap-up statement?
Yes, I think that what's happened here should be a lesson to everybody in this country about the power of unions. And it's not so much just the tremendous fellowship that we got from other unions or the particular deal that we got or education, generally speaking. But I think we need a new labor movement in this country. And I'm hoping that what we've done here awakens not only people who are involved in our profession, but labor unions across the country. We're also starting to see unions cropping up, even at private institutions where people have been mistreated for decades, right? The way to move the needle in our system right now is unionization, period. Period. It is, as I always say in all my communications to faculty at East Bay, together we are strong. I think we've proven that here.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Nick. Andy, a wrap-up statement from you?
I absolutely agree. The unions are the last organization that will provide opportunities to retain the middle class. And this was a fight for the middle class. This was a victory for the middle class. And Nick is absolutely right. With the union, we're going to be strong. And this hopefully will plow the ground to sow the seeds for more unionization.
Well, thank you very much, Andy and Nick, for being on the show today. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today to our producer, Anthony Best, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 32 stations across the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We will see you next time.